Hi, I'm Scott Jens. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon and Virtual DragonCon this year. It's unfortunate we can't be there in person, but we will do the best we can with the technology we have. And I'd like to thank everyone who is attending virtually. This is Ask the EFF, and we'll spend a little time on Meet the EFA. I don't see Fabian in here yet, but let me see.
Hey, Fabian just joined us.
Okay, he just joined us. Okay. Yeah, okay, there, I see the name. Good. And so, again, to ask questions, just put them in the chat, or if you want to come on camera, you can use the raise hand feature. And the way you do that is to click on your own name and set your status to raise, and we'll look for the hand icon. And then we can call on you. You just flip on your camera if you'd like to do that, and your microphone, and come on if you'd like to do it that way, whichever works for you. And let's see, there's, okay, Fabian, hi.
Hey.
Hello.
Fabian.
Hello, how's everybody doing?
How's everyone going? Yeah, how's it going?
Good.
Okay, yeah, we're just getting started here, and I was just starting to introduce what we're doing. We're gonna split it up between Ask the EFF and Meet the EFA. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough time to put together a more representative panel for the EFA. We'll try to just mention that kind of briefly, but we would like to hear some about what STOP is doing and how they're working together with the EFA when we get to that point. I'd like to start off with introductions. So if you could, each one, if you could introduce yourself and let us know what your role is in the organization, which organization you're with, because there's multiples here, and kind of what you're working on these days. So let's start with Erica.
Hi, I'm Erica Portnoy. I'm a technologist at EFF. I split my time working as an engineer on CertBot, which is EFF's Let's Encrypt client that helps people turn on HTTPS for their websites. And I also do a lot of the technical side of our crypto policy work. What we've been doing there lately has been focused on EARNIT and LATO, which are two bills that have been introduced that are not so great for encryption. They have good intentions in mind, but at the end of the day, they're not going to be great for the internet. So we've been trying to put a stop to them.
Okay, Fabian, go ahead.
Yeah. Good evening, everybody. My name is Fabian Rogers. I'm coming here speaking on behalf of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, which they go by the acronym STOP. Basically, I come here to say thank you on behalf of Albert, the founder of the company, just because our aim, besides doing a lot of advocacy against anti-surveillance technology in different places from public and mainly within the public sector, is aiming to avoid any sort of surveillance tech issue or biometric surveillance tech issue within any sort of community that feels impacted. And I actually come from a background of doing a lot of tenant pushback against my landlord from installing a facial recognition. So I come here to say thank you for putting an effort forward to collaborate with many different grassroots organizations in the country overall. It means a lot, and it helps the work be a bit easier because it's hard to do it by yourself. So thank you all for having me. Thank you for including us as an organization. Look forward to continuing the work together.
Okay, Haley?
Hi, I'm Haley Tsukayama. I'm with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I am legislative activist, so I work on the activism team on legislation. It is my very great pleasure, actually, to work on state legislation all across the country. Right now, a lot of state legislatures have closed business for the year, so I'm working on a lot of letters to governors. It's, as I said, I get to work with a lot of people all across the country, including the fine folks at EF Georgia, and I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, Kurt? And we're not hearing you.
The old mute button.
Everybody take a shot.
Classic error. Anyway, hello, everybody. My name is Kurt Opsahl. I am the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I've been with EFF for the 16th year, and I've been working a lot on the legal side of things. I lead the Coders Rights Project. That is a project where we help people, especially security researchers, with the legal questions surrounding doing security research and publicizing the results, disclosing the results of that research, and generally try to help people navigate that so that we can get more information out to the public about how to secure our important computer infrastructure and electronic systems. One of the things I like to put as a caveat for all of these Ask the EFF talks is that while we do represent people for free to help them with their situations, if you have a question about your particular situation, this is not the forum to ask that question. You want to have a attorney-client privilege conversation about anything dealing with your particular situation, and we should have that offline. If you ever need EFF's legal assistance, you can reach out to info@eff.org, where it will go into our intake system and somebody will get back to you. You know, we're a relatively small organization. We cannot help everybody who may need help, but we will do our best to either help you or find someone who can. That said, for this, this is the Ask the EFF. It's an open forum to ask your questions. So you can ask all sorts of questions hitting on EFF topics. That would be privacy, free expression, innovation. We will answer them if we can. We have a limited selection here on the panel, so maybe that some questions will be outside our expertise, but there's lots of interesting topics to talk about. Some other things that I've worked on, recently EFF filed a amicus brief in a case called Van Buren versus the United States before the United States Supreme Court, and this is the Supreme Court addressing very important questions about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That is the federal anti-hacking law. It has some ambiguous terms, and this is an opportunity to resolve these terms so that the CFAA does not put a chill on important security research where somebody might be concerned about accidentally committing a felony when they're trying to just to make computers more secure. So we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will take that case and find that what it means through unauthorized access to computers is hacking, and that violations of terms of service or contractual agreements around a site does not turn your otherwise not hacking access into hacking. I've also been working a bit with Erica on encryption policy. So on the EARNIT, as you mentioned, a very important issue. There's actually a panel where we'll be discussing EARNIT directly tomorrow, I think at 5 o'clock Eastern. Is that right, Scott?
I'll have to check. That sounds about right.
So you can tune into that. It will be a blast from the past because that panel was recorded about a month ago. But nevertheless, I'll go into greater detail about EARNIT. And also, we're just generally trying to make sure that your encryption remains strong and that they're not government mandated backdoors or other encryption flaws that will undermine the security of something that we all depend upon. There's lots of little things.
That is 5 o'clock, by the way. So 5 o'clock.
Check it out tomorrow. And I think we're doing a watch party and then Q&A after. So check it out. We'll let it go on to the next panelist, but I look forward to your questions.
Okay, thank you. Nash.
Yeah, hello, I'm Nash. I am the Associate Director of Community Organizing at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which means I get to work with all of the folks on this panel today. I manage the organizing team, and one of the roles that we play at EFF is being kind of the conduit between EFF and the work that we do to protect, protecting your rights in the digital world, and the Electronic Frontier Alliance, which is a network of right now 79 grassroots and community organizations and student groups around the country that largely fit into three kind of major buckets, not all, but largely fit into three major buckets. And today we have two great examples with us. Scott, in addition to his work with DragonCon, as I mentioned, he also is one of the key and core organizers at Electronic Frontiers Georgia, one of the longest, maybe tied with EF Austin, member, you know, associated group with EFF and kind of even predating the Electronic Frontier Alliance. And also Fabian and Albert and the folks at Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. And in addition, those are advocacy groups. And then in addition, in the Alliance, we also have a number of hacker spaces like Crash Space in Los Angeles or Root Access in Fresno that are creating opportunities and spaces for folks to come together and share tools and resources and skills to actually take real control over the things that they own and to innovate and create. And then, of course, we also have groups like Cyper Collective in Brooklyn, New York, or Future Ada in Spokane, Washington, that are doing popular education. So really giving folks the information that they need to make informed choices around the technology that they own. And all of those groups are completely autonomous. You know, just we come together as a network to share skills and resources and tools to make sure that we're able to better serve the folks in the different communities and areas that we're working in, but in a way that is appropriate for each community, not under an idea that, like, you know, any one plan is one size fits all for every community. And so it's really amazing. Then Kurt actually mentioned some of the principles of the Electronic Frontier Alliance, which are really the core things that bring people, that bring all the groups together, the thing that, you know, although we are all autonomous, that we kind of coalesce around. And those are privacy, creativity, innovation, access to knowledge, and security. And so really any group that, you know, you have three more folks and you're creating opportunities for folks to come together and learn and take better control and access to the way that your life is, the way that the digital world intersects with your life, be it your technology or on the internet or what have you. Those are all great groups that we would love to work with within the Alliance. And so, you know, Erica and Kurt and Haley as well, and many of our colleagues within EFF are kind of really like amazing, you know, experts within that really take deep dives into the a really deep dive of knowledge within the areas that they're working in. With the organizing team at EFF, you know, while we certainly our main goal is to make sure that we're sharing the skills to be able to support the groups and being able to do effective advocacy and education in their own communities, but then of course requires us to kind of have a working knowledge of a lot of the things that we're working on across the organization and across our issue areas. So it's really for someone like me who it's a really great experience, you know, coming out of, you know, Fabian mentioned coming out of kind of like an organizing and the work that Fabian and his neighbors did in Brooklyn to be able to stop being their landlord from forcing a face surveillance entry system on them is amazing and really inspiring. And so similarly, I come out of an organizing background that then would need to require, because of direct action organizing, needed to be able to support folks that we were working with and realize that the sensitive information that we were needing to collect to help folks through their interactions with the criminal system and law enforcement needed to become very well informed on the way that digital security, the way that we can manage that information, secure that information in really reliable ways. That's kind of the path that's led me here to EFF, where I'm really have really overjoyed to be able to work and support the work that's happening around the country in protecting folks' rights in the digital world.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. So I guess I want to kick off with the first question of my own. It's a little bit foreshadowing what we'll talk about tomorrow. I think we'll go more in depth tomorrow. But I wanted to go back and talk briefly about the Earn It Act. That's the act that proposes to modify Section 230. And I heard, I saw an alert about changing the Earn It Act to give more power to the states and let the states write laws that could individually modify Section 230. I wonder if you can give us any more details on that?
Haley, have you been following the state-led aspects of Earn It?
I haven't actually seen many bills introduced. You know, we've heard some people talk about it, but I think that's fairly new.
I mean, as a general matter, one of the reasons why Section 230, this is Let me say it plain as it is for those who have not been following along. Section 230 is a provision of the Telecommunications Act of 96, specifically the Communications Decency Act that was part of it, that was it basically said that the soapbox is not liable for what the speaker has said. That, you know, much as, you know, you don't hold the phone company liable for what someone says on a phone call, you don't hold the postal system liable for someone who writes in a letter, that you don't hold the platforms liable as if they were the publisher of what one of the users has said. And this law was vital for the creation of user-generated content sites. Things like, you know, YouTube and you know, Facebook, social media, where the users are generating content and there's more of it than could possibly be reviewed and vetted by you know, legal counsel, determine whether it would cause liability. So the paradigm case is if somebody writes something that's allegedly defamatory on a website, you know, to know something's defamatory, it has to be a false statement. And there's very little way for a website to determine if somebody has written a false statement in the ordinary course of things, especially if it's about two people who they have no prior knowledge of. So without something like Section 230, the websites would have to be extraordinarily cautious about what content that they allow, make sure that it is not going to present them with liability, which makes it a free speech issue. That if, you know, the damages you might have would be hundreds of thousands of dollars and there was a 99% chance that everything was fine, that 1% of hundreds of thousands of dollars adds up to a fair amount of money, especially over a lot of posts. And this was one of the reasons why the internet was a big break from the previous systems where there were like cable companies or newspapers who were the conduits through which everything had to pass. And it really led to an explosion of user-generated content, which I think by and large has been for the good. Though one of the things that's happened over the last several years is we've also noticed that some of the challenging aspects, of the bad aspects that come from a lot of from content online, and this has put 230 under a little bit of pressure. With all that in mind, as a background, EARNIT was not about that. EARNIT was, hey, you like Section 230 companies, well, we want you to break encryption, so if you don't break encryption, we're going to take away this law that you depend on. So it was really very tangentially actually related to 230 and mostly related to how much companies rely on it. But one of the things that is necessary for 230 to work is that it is a single nationwide standard. I mean, and actually, it really needs to work in conjunction with other international standards, because if you have that the rules are different in every possible jurisdiction, then this would push companies to have the most restrictive jurisdiction. So I haven't looked closely at this proposal to have 230 stop preempting state law and allow states to pick and choose how they want to have 230 apply to cases in their states, but I would be very suspicious that the net result of a 50-state approach to whether a nationwide or international social media company, online publisher, online platform would be treated for user-generated content would have a net effect of really stepping back on the ability to host John. And if this was like as EARNIT is as a whole, tied into whether or not they provide the backdoors for encryption to law enforcement, well, that would make it a bigger, unrelated hammer to go after the sites.
Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns with a 50-state approach is that you could have a situation where sites are held to the standards of the most restrictive state. And that was I think that was an issue with the Communications Decency Act also overall before it was ruled on.
It's definitely been a historic issue with decency-related stuff, or in particular, actually, obscenity statutes, where the standard for what is obscene was a community standard, which may have made sense in a time when You know, communities were very separated, and so you might have one community that had a very lax standard of what would be obscene. Another one had a very, you know, tight standard of what would be obscene. But this, in the early days of the internet, were there were a number of challenges around that, where people who were opposed to having sexual material online would go and bring their case about it in the most restrictive possible community, and then say it violated those community standards, and trying to actually, as a strategy, affect their nationwide goals by exploiting the differences in jurisdiction and picking the ones that fit them best.
Okay, I see we have a user named Fran, who's got her hand raised. You can turn on your camera and your microphone, or if you're not able to do that, you can post in chat.
Okay, go ahead, Fran.
Fran, if you're there.
And we also got a question in chat about voting machines.
Yeah, would you like to take the question in chat?
Sure. So the question in the chat is referring to last year, a panel on insecure, easily hacked voting machines. So this year I saw that the Georgia primary was pushed from March the 3rd to March the 23rd. Are there any other court cases in process or in queue? So I guess there's a couple of issues being raised there. One is about election security. And you know, we do indeed have a lot of more work to do to make sure that our voting systems are as secure as they possibly can be. I believe that voter-verified paper trails is really the best way to go on that. A number of states have followed into that and started to go in that direction, but not all states, and I believe not Georgia. Georgia still has direct entry voting machines, I believe. These raise some security issues. Now, I would note that not to get overly dramatic about this, because to actually have a significant effect on any election, hacking individual machines is a pretty labor-intensive process. It is not something that is easily done. We want them to be as secure as possible, but this is not to say that you cannot trust the results that come, because these are it would be extraordinarily difficult for someone to do that effectively. However, we're also worried about a lot of other things having to do with voting security, because one goal of those who are trying to disrupt the vote would be to create uncertainty, to create that fear that the votes are not being properly tabulated, not being properly counted. And that can be done by anecdotal things which may not actually have an effect on the substance of it, but create that doubt. So these are some reasons we also need to look for voting security on the security of the tabulation websites, the security of the Secretary of State websites that display the results so that someone can't break into them and try to put in false results. So these are all things that are very important. It may be a little bit less important this year in some sense, as states are moving more to voting by mail, which has some pretty well understood security properties. I know there's some talk about insecurity for those, but actually it is a pretty well understood and has been successfully used in a lot of jurisdictions and has less problems than some of the direct entry machines. And the question was also mentioning the pushing the primary. Honestly, I don't know much about that. A lot of primaries were pushed on account of coronavirus to get more time to be able to handle it. And I think I would say more right now should be forward-looking, try to figure out in your jurisdiction, whether Georgia or anywhere else, that there are mechanisms in place to allow for voting to proceed in a time when there are risks of showing up places in person, such as voting by mail, drop-offs, and if machines are being used, and these sorts of things.
Okay. All right, thanks. Nash, we got the question. I see that you answered the question in the chat, but let's highlight it Let's actually bring it out and highlight it on camera. So the question was about Spokane, the organization in Spokane.
Yeah, so Spokane, there is a link in the chat, and I definitely recommend folks taking a look. I was really happy to be able to profile FutureAid. FutureAid does really amazing work. It is a group in Spokane, Washington, that was started from originally Rebecca Long, who's a technologist who was experiencing, you know, a lot of problems with, you know, as a woman in an industry that is extremely male dominated, finding herself, you know, with the folks, you know, whether it be women or folks who are members of other marginalized groups, especially in the tech field, groups that are underrepresented can probably relate to relate and probably are familiar with the experience about what we call imposter syndrome, right? Where it's a common experience with folks who are members of under-marginalized groups in the tech field and other fields as well, that feel like their contributions aren't enough, that they're not qualified enough, even though they may have higher qualifications and be more experienced than other folks that are not experiencing those same problems as a result of their identity. And they Rebecca wanted to start a group that could really help women who were in the tech field be able to feel supported and have opportunities to gain the information and knowledge that they needed to advance in their career. And at the same time, another friend of EFF, who's been a friend of EFF for even before joining FutureAid, Emily St. Pierre, who is moving from Las Vegas to Spokane, Washington, connected us with the group. And since then, you know, FutureAid has really grown and really understanding the ways that intersectionality plays, and that, you know, when a rising tide raises all ships. And so they've really expanded their work to really make sure that folks who are parts of underrepresented communities in tech have the support that they need, that they have the information that they need, and particularly in their own community of Spokane, Washington. And obviously their name is also, you know, it sources back to Ada Lovelace, who's really recognized as one of the first coders, period, you know, and obviously a really an inspirational figure for a lot of women in the tech community. So it was really great to be able to highlight the work that FutureAid is doing and how they've, some of the challenges that they've experienced and the work that they've done to overcome those challenges.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so we're open for additional questions now. If you'd like to put a question in the chat, or if you'd like to pop on your camera or use the raise hand feature by your name. We'll be open for additional questions now.
All right. Yeah, you come on. You have a question. I know you do. If not, I guess we can start talking about some of the other things that that we're working on. Nash, how about you want to talk maybe about some of our CCOPS initiatives?
Sure, I would love to. So folks have probably seen, you know, in the news over the last several months, there's been a lot of you know, protests and action calling for, you know, more accountability in the way that police interact, and you know, so more recently we've seen, you know, calls for defunding of the police. And obviously EFF, our mission is very focused on technology, and one of the things that we've been doing for several years that kind of intersects with some of the things that we're seeing in the news more recently is this campaigns to make sure that there is an accountability process, that there is a public voice in the ways that different communities are acquiring police and privacy invasive surveillance technology, not just for the police but for all government agencies. And so since 2016, along with partners like ACLU and our EFA members, Oakland Privacy, and as well as Surveillance Technology Oversight Project that Fabian works with, we've been advancing what's called Community Control over Police Surveillance, or Surveillance Equipment Regulation Ordinances. And what these ordinances do is, you know, a lot of times, because funding comes from, you know, DHS grants, or from, you know, maybe it's even equipment that's given Department of Defense's 1033 program, there is no opportunity for elected officials to weigh in and have a voice in the process. And just as importantly, if not more importantly, there's no opportunity, or very often there's no even opportunity to be informed for many members of the public about the privacy invasive surveillance technology that's being acquired in their communities. Very often it is just agency executives that are in that process, and usually the only experts, the only experts that are involved in that process are the folks from the vendors. So there's no there's really no, you know, fair or voice that's really looking out for the interests of the civil liberties and protections and rights of the people within those communities. So since 2016, with the in where it started in Santa Clara. We've been working and passing these ordinances, and we've passed similar ordinances in recently this earlier this year. A slightly modified version of a CCOPS ordinance passed in New York, very much led by, very much spearheaded by the folks at Surveillance Technology Oversight Project called the POST Act. And while the POST Act is really focused on simply on the transparency piece, a lot of the others also have accountability processes, which mean that before a police department or any city or government agency can acquire or continue to use a particular type of surveillance equipment, they need to present a use policy as well as a disparate impact report. So really saying, like, what are the conditions under, what are the requirements under which their employees will be allowed to use this technology, and also what is the potential for disparate impact against different members of the community. And now when we think about face surveillance, for instance, we know it's been, you know, Joy Bilimwini at MIT, and now at the Algorithmic Justice Center, as well as Claire Garvey at the Georgetown Center for Privacy and Technology, have done really amazing work and really documenting the disparate impact that both on how the technology works in the way it's designed, as well as how the disparate impact of the way it's being used by police departments across the country, and have really highlighted that. But we really want to think it's also additionally important to recognize that even if the technology worked 100% correctly, the threat that it presents to our First Amendment rights to be able to move and to go to protest and visit, you know, maybe LGBTQ centers or maybe a religious institution without the fear that we're going to be constantly monitored and that there might be retribution for our exercise of our First Amendment protected rights, as well as the Fourth Amendment privacy concerns that are inherent in the use of the technology, even if it worked 100% correctly, are way too high for us to trade away for some theoretical presentation of some theoretical opportunity for safety that hasn't been borne out. And so folks may know that last year in San Francisco, we passed the first face surveillance ban in the country. And so that, but what folks may not realize is that was actually passed as an addition to existing CCOPS model legislation. And so San Francisco CCOPS ordinance was the first one to actually also include a face surveillance ban. And so subsequently, we've added those to CCOPS bans that had already been passed in Berkeley and Oakland. And now, right now, bringing the work full circle, you know, when I started off by talking about some of the protests that we've seen in the streets that came out of the murder of George Floyd, and right now in the city of Minneapolis, they're actually have an opportunity to pass the most comprehensive and the most protective community control over police surveillance, and the most empowering to the people of that city community control over police surveillance ordinance in the country, because not only does it do what the San Francisco ordinance does, which is to provide that requirement for a use policy, to provide a disparate impact report, to require that the public has an opportunity to comment before elected officials, not agency executives, decide whether that technology can be used, and require annual reporting, but it also expands beyond just the surveillance equipment, beyond just banning face surveillance, then it also it adds those same requirements for militarized equipment. So folks may remember years ago when we were looking, you know, during the uprising in Ferguson, where we saw in the streets of St. Louis these armored vehicles. And actually at one point, the Los Angeles Union Free School District had acquired a rocket launcher from the Department of Defense. Why a school district needs a rocket launcher, I don't think there's very many people on this call that would be able to answer that. I don't know if even the Union Free School District in Los Angeles can answer it, because they eventually gave it back. But the ordinance that's being presented now in Minneapolis actually would add, it's now it's called CCOPS plus M, because it also adds those same requirements for militarized equipment. Remember, militarized equipment, you know, I'm talking about the rocket launchers and the armored vehicles, but also remember that, you know, things like cell site simulators originally were used against enemy combatants in other parts of the world, with many of those same concerns, mind you, but now they're being used they're being used in our own communities. So when we look at, you know, there's a fuzzier line between the militarized equipment and surveillance equipment than folks may realize. So it's important to be able to pass legislation that's going to really recognize that difference and provide those protections for those things that may fit into that gray area as well. So again, the CCOPS ordinance is something that has obviously led the way for us to make really informed decisions and to create the opportunity for dialogue and a democratic process in the acquisition of surveillance equipment.
Okay. And X-Ray is saying it must be for the school model rocketry club.
Fair enough. Rocketry clubs can be a lot of fun. The key thing, though, is you want your rocket from the rocketry club not to explode when it gets to its destination. A failure of that. Do we have anybody with their hand raised?
I don't see any new hands raised. We only had the one thing in chat. I think one of the things that you brought up, Nash, is about protests and about, one of the things that came to mind is our digital devices. If we're taking our digital device into something that we intend to be a peaceful protest, it's a little bit like a homing beacon. What can we do in that situation, to kind of protect our identity, to keep information from that protest from being used against us later?
Sure. Well, obviously, one of the first things that folks want to really think about is what is their particular, what we call threat analysis. So, like, what is their particular risk? And for all of us, that's going to be a slightly different calculation. And so we have, if you look at EFF Surveillance Self-Defense Guide, which is at ssd.eff.org, or even the Security Education Companion, if you're that person that's really being called on to share this information with people in your community, which is the way that largely the way that I first got into this work. The Security Education Companion is a great way with resources on how to actually think through your particular threat or risk scenarios. But so after doing that, you may come to a couple different solutions. One might be to simply, before you go to the protest, put your phone in airplane mode, right? And so that way you're not actually, cell site simulators, there's kind of two different kinds. One, and Erica is absolutely way more qualified to speak to the specifics of the technology than I, but there's two different types. There's the passive that are simply picking up information similar to like an FM receiver would and grabbing fish. And those are very difficult to identify. Those are almost impossible to identify if they're being used or not. And then you have, cell site simulators that are more active, that are actually both that are both picking up as well as transmitting information. And in either one of those scenarios, if your phone is in airplane mode, then you won't be caught. And actually, some of the work that Fabian and Surveillance Technology Oversight Project is doing right now in using geolocation tracking and stopping geolocation tracking rather, really calls into the fact that when you're using a cell site simulator, it's not just the one person at the protest who you think might be particularly problematic. Every phone in that area is being picked up, right? And so there's certainly significant concerns around the ways that folks are being identified and tracked in very unwarranted ways. So by having your phone in airplane mode, you are going to prevent that. You may though decide that actually you need to be able to communicate during the time that you're there, and that airplane mode in a phone is not going to be the best way for you to do that. And you may have the resources to be able to get a burner phone. Now, if you do decide that you're going to get a burner phone so you have a greater opportunity for anonymity in your attending the protest, there's a couple of things that you're going to want to do and really think through in advance, though, is one, never having your phone that's like easily identified with you and your burner phone on in the same location, certainly not having them on in a way that's going to create an opportunity for them to be correlated. Because obviously you would lose a significant amount of the anonymization that's provided through the burner phone. Another thing you might want to do if you're going to use the opportunity to put your phone in airplane mode before going to the protest, you might realize that you may also need to be able to recognize where you are, or identify where you are. And if you go to our SSD guide on protest, you'll see that there's a couple of apps that you can use that allow you to use GPS. And the good thing is that GPS is a receive-only system. And so you can use GPS while having your cellular transmitter off. But if you're going to use a lot of those apps, you will have to have thought about this in advance and download maps that can be used with those apps that don't require your actual cellular data to be using to be on in order to use the GPS mapping feature. So there's a lot of things you can do, and we do have an entire playlist specifically for folks that are thinking about attending protests or things or for activists, as well as playlists for journalists and others, other specific risk scenarios on our surveillance self-defense guide. So definitely go there. And if you're going to a protest, you might want to, even if you have access to a printer, there's also a pocket guide that we've made that you can kind of fold up and hand out to other folks, so that if you know others that are attending protests with you, that they can have some of that guidance and to be able to think through the way that they're going to try to protect their own privacy while still being able to exercise their First Amendment rights and have their voices be heard. Thanks for asking that, Scott, and absolutely, stay strong and stay safe. And remember that privacy is a team sport. So the decisions that you're making, you're not just making them for yourself. You're making them for everyone whose information has been entrusted to you.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like with COVID, you need to protect the others around you, yep, as well as yourself. So Fabian, would you like to add any about the cell site simulators and the situation in New York?
Yeah, the interesting thing when Nash brings up the geofence warrants is just like the idea of the violation of like your Fourth Amendment right, which is like the idea of particularity and things like that, and the general mass collection of like data is very problematic in a sense. So geofence warrants is like a thing to push back against, because the idea of the large mass that like a entity would have to funnel through in order to find the needle in the haystack for whatever perp or whatever clue they're trying to follow. So you have that in terms of COVID, the idea of using COVID-19 as a sort of blanket as a blanket excuse in order to push forward the need for surveillance technology to be further implanted in places that generally didn't have that sense of invasiveness or that much of an invasive relationship with technology. So like COVID-19 tracking and tracing in schools, whether it's campuses or K-12, that type of problem, or the need for COVID-19 tracing within the workplace, things like that become problematic. So I'm still fairly new to the company, of course. I have a general sense that they're pushing back against the geofence warrants and the COVID-19 tracing, particularly within schools, both K-12 and campuses, just from the fact of invasiveness on both sides, that come at a violation of Amendment 4 rights generally, where it's like you're getting too general of information that puts too many at harm in terms of their personal data in order to try to look or try to preemptively suspect the perp that you're looking for, the perpetrator that you're looking for, things like that. So I think just because, this all falls from the fact that technology moves much faster than legislation, as we all clearly know. That's not to say that legislation isn't effective, it just hasn't caught up to the almost churning workflow of technology overall, specifically surveillance technology. And as Nash brought up, surveillance technology isn't even at a point of efficacy where it's where it should be tested in places that really compromise the personal data and personal being of people. What I feel, the general sense of what we're fighting against is the avoidance of allowing public areas where people should be free to go about their business. We're trying to avoid those public areas and even private, I guess, areas such as like school areas and things like that, but really public sector, anything that could be handled by government funding or anything like that, avoiding those places to be attack areas essentially that would deal with very invasive surveillance that we have yet to see ever. Since you thought about, surveillance within like the FBI dating back from decades ago to thinking about now. So the idea is avoiding public areas being a test pool for algorithms and algorithmic technologies or surveillance technologies to build a sort of efficacy through data that they weren't in mind in the first place. if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Haley.
Thanks.
So was reminding me, I think, Haley, am I right in remembering that you're working on some state legislation having to do with geofence warrants, perhaps even in New York?
Yes, well, we're happy to support STOP in their efforts there. They have a bill that looks really good, and I think the author is very excited about it. So we're really looking forward to working with you folks on that, especially over the next session. And yeah, you brought up a lot of issues that are pretty hot right now, actually, in legislation across the country. I think if you're thinking about the intersection of privacy and surveillance and COVID-19 and sort of all of these state programs, those are issues that we're seeing come up in legislatures across the country. And, you know, in a lot of cases, we're just trying to get, you know, you're certainly right that legislation is often lags behind technology, but we are looking at ways to sort of get basic principles, technology agnostic principles on the books, right? To say, you know, don't collect more data than you need to, get rid of it when you don't need it anymore. These sort of really basic things that I think can help deal with a lot of those situations.
Okay, we had something in the post about a recent court case finding geofence warrants unconstitutional. Now, that was not a Supreme Court case, as I understand it, but was it appellate or district?
This was two magistrate judges and then a district. So these are low-level decisions, right? Which is actually that makes a lot of sense because it is the low-level judges who are approving surveillance technologies, right? They are given an application by the law enforcement to try to approve it. What they were trying to do there were these geofence warrants, where they would get information about everybody in a particular, often, you know, highly populated urban area, and then try to compare that against the ones that they thought might have committed the crime, and the courts were recognizing that did not have a particularity, as Fabian was just noting. Part of what is the Fourth Amendment requires is particularity. When we created the Fourth Amendment, after the Revolutionary War, it was in reaction in part to the general warrants of the British, that the British government at the time would provide a general warrant that allowed somebody to look for whatever they wanted. Right? They didn't have to know that it was at this person's house or that they were looking for this particular contraband. They could just have this piece of paper in their hand, bust into one of the colonist houses, and search it top to bottom, trying to find evidence of wrongdoing. And the colonists really didn't like that. So after having won the Revolutionary War, separating from England, they had the Fourth Amendment to make sure that sort of behavior would not be allowed. And I think what we've seen both, in geofence warrants, now some, you know, couple of cases pushing back. The government, I think, you know, still has time to appeal those. So those may eventually go up the court chain to a point where they are more significant opinions because they're at the appellate level. So we may actually get some more rulings on that. Though we'll see. There are also times when the government loses occasionally in front of a magistrate judge, but those are not precedential decisions. And if they're winning enough elsewhere and they're afraid of what a appellate court or a higher court would say, there's no reason to rock the boat unless you think you're going to get a favorable, just as EFF, we try to find the best cases to bring it to an appeals court. Well, the government does it the same, though I would say they have more of an obligation to do justice, and that is not particularly doing justice. I also, since we're on the topic, wanted to mention there was speaking of widespread mass surveillance, there was a case that came out yesterday that was addressing the metadata collection program, the nationwide metadata collection program that stemmed from some of the authorities seized by the government right after the attacks of September 11th. And the court found that it was in their words, it was likely unconstitutional, but was illegal. There's sort of a notion that courts don't hit constitutional questions if they don't have to. We believe it is unconstitutional, but very importantly, that case also found that the people had the right to challenge it. And we've been litigating against the NSA post 9/11 surveillance program, I guess originally in 2006. And the current case actually was dated from 2008, so for a dozen years. And a lot of that litigation is about whether or not we have the right to challenge it, as opposed to whether or not it is lawful. And so I think this will be a useful new opinion on at least whether or not it can be challenged. And I think the court was right that it is likely, in fact, so likely because it is, in fact, unconstitutional.
Okay. All right. If there's any other questions, feel free to put them in the chat.
Since the topic of COVID tracking apps have come out, or contact tracing, exposure notification mm-hmm. apps, and the link that Nash just put in there, COVID-19 and digital rights, we've had a number of posts about the privacy and fundamental rights principles that come into play when looking at these contact tracing, exposure notification apps. These are things that may be helpful in stopping the spread of the coronavirus and some people from getting COVID-19. But we can't do them while sacrificing our civil liberties. I think that the better form have been those apps that are relying more on proximity detection and exposure notification without getting information about your particular locations. Some of the worst are the ones that use GPS and create a permanent track of where you've been. And then to hit one of the points was raised a little bit earlier about their use in schools. We've seen some circumstances where students have been required to use these apps, including ones that not only require location, but there was one for a university that turned out to have security flaws, but yet all the students were being required to use it. So we have to make sure these things are absolutely as secure as they can be, which requires rigorous testing. So this is still an evolving thing. The latest big news on that is that there is the Apple-Google protocol, an API originally, for doing Bluetooth-based exposure notification. We're starting to see apps rolled out that use that protocol. But also in the most recent version of iOS, I think it's 13.7, the most recent one, it now has that built in. You still have to opt into it, so it won't just turn on by default, which is very important. No one should be forced to use these apps. It should be always optional, but it may actually allow people to use it without an app. How you feel about that is probably related heavily to how you feel about Apple and Google. But I think we have to call upon those companies to be absolutely transparent about how the apps are work and what the safety, security, privacy protocols and how your information will be protected so that people can make a decision about whether they want to use them.
Okay, we got a question about the voting technology in the chat. So why is there so much inertia for direct recording and ballot marking device voting machines, despite every voting technology expert saying they cannot be audited? Despite this, the politicians keep saying risk limiting audits in the context of DRE and BMD voting machines. These devices cannot be audited using risk limiting audit methods.
I feel like I've talked a bunch, but I'm happy to at least start.
Go for it.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, and I think that for some time now we've really been kind of advocating and pushing for, and there's a clear need, and Scott and the folks at the of Georgia where I've worked on this a bit too, in trying to make sure that in the state of Georgia that there actually were voting machines that had voter verifiable paper ballots, right? Because it is critically important that voters be able to have some level of assurance that the vote that they're actually entering in is actually what's being recorded, and that not only that is happening in the moment, but actually that if we've seen for anyone here that's been to DEF CON has seen how quickly some very young and then even experienced and even just getting their chops folks have been able to compromise the voting machines that currently exist. So without that paper ballot, without that ability to be able to go back and run these risk limiting audits that can give us a level of assurance that what's been entered by the voters is actually what's being tabulated, there are considerable concerns. I know in Georgia for as an example, there they I think they ultimately, and Scott correct me if I'm wrong, that they ultimately went with voting machines that did not have a voter verifiable paper ballot. There was some record that was created after the fact, but that could also be fairly easily manipulated in this work without there being a record to be able to go back to. So to say that if someone was to compromise the system, the auditing that was available within through that device would also be compromised, right? And so one of the problems that we're experiencing is the fact that one of the reasons that we have these problems throughout the country is that these decisions are happening on a very local level, right? They're all happening within communities and districts. And when there's been, and after following the 2016 elections, there was policy that was presented that would have created an opportunity for both funding as well as guidance to be given from the federal government to assist local legislators in both having the information that they would need to be able to make informed choices around the appropriate machines that they should be adopting, as well as the funding and the funding and support that they would need to be able to do things like risk limiting audits that would provide that assurance. And because of advocacy from the administration and elsewhere, we didn't get those things. But so now I'm getting a bunch of feedback in my headphones, so I don't know if everyone else is hearing that or not. I'm sorry. But now because we lack that, we are in a position where in many districts throughout the country, we are not going to be able to have that assurance. But again. I just want to end with saying that, I will end it there, and I imagine that Kurt or someone else will want to add on to that.
Well, I can speak a little bit to Georgia. We did, it was very controversial, but we did start replacing our systems. We had the old DRE type systems, and we replaced it with a ballot marking device system. Okay, they're saying my audio is garbled. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. So we did replace our system with the ballot marking device type system. I was I was engaged through Electronic Frontiers Georgia and looking at the enabling law, and I have actually voted with that system already. Basically you would make your choices on a touchscreen, and it actually prints a piece of paper, and the piece of paper has your choices on it, and you have to understand that you need to check that the choices that you made are actually on the piece of paper. But it also comes with a barcode, and we had an enabling law to basically enable and legalize these machines last year. And one of the biggest problems that there were many problems with the bill, but one of the biggest problems was that the human readable portion of the ballot that was printed was not the ballot of record. And actually, the record was in a barcode, so you can't really tell when you're looking at the barcode whether that matches your intent, even though you can see the human readable portion. And what happens is after it prints out, you have to put it into a slot in a device where it goes into a lockbox, and it's supposed to stay secure in the lockbox. But I just don't know. Any voting system is fine until somebody disputes the results. So I just don't really know what's going to happen once the results are disputed. The language of the bill did mention risk-limiting audits, but you know, I don't know that the process under which that is, I don't know how, if the process under which that is conducted is a very public process, or if I can go, you know, can I be a part of the process? Can I see the results of this risk limiting audit? I don't know if I can do that as a member of the general public. So there were a lot of concerns that we had, and those are some of the top concerns I remember from last year.
I did a lot of analysis on the voting machines for EFGA, and it boils down to, in order to do risk limiting audits, this is based on the professor out in California who came up with the theory and the methods of doing risk limited audit, that you have to have a 100% verifiable vote by every voter. So whenever you enter data into a machine, you're hoping the machine interpreted your actions into what you actually meant. And at that point, you no longer have verified that what the machine outputs is in fact what the person intended. They actually did a test where they gave people a ballot and said, please vote. And the ballots recorded some information correctly, and in some cases, all of the information correctly, in some cases, recorded some bad information. And the idea is, could the people actually detect the errors and were there false positives? And the fact is, there's false positives, which is not a problem. You can redo your ballot. The false negative false negative is where you have bad data and they didn't detect it. Then they also did a test of where they encouraged people to check their ballots, and they watched how many people actually did. And the typical person took less than 30 seconds to review their ballot. Now, I take a paper ballot with me and review mine meticulously every time I vote as best I can. We use direct marking devices as opposed, or direct recording devices, although we moved to the new ones for this election. And it is not possible in 30 seconds to review your ballot. So the bottom line is, when given the opportunity, people just don't verify their ballot. And if it's not verified, you cannot audit the ballot. That's a mathematical certainty. So the only method we know of ensuring that you've actually recorded to the best ability of the voter their actual intention is on a handwritten ballot where they mark in a bubble thing and they record it. That's the only mechanism we know of capturing it that does not put some kind of technology or recording device or interpretation or multiple levels of interpretation between what the person actually meant and what actually gets recorded. And the only known way of doing a risk limited audit is with these paper ballots. Despite that, every politician, when they bring up these voting machines, throws the magic fairy dust of risk limiting audit over the top of it. And in fact, the author of risk limiting audit himself says these machines cannot be audited, just straight up. Whether they print a verifiable ballot or not, cannot be audited, period. Every expert that I know of in voting technology testified before to the working group here in Georgia that gave the final recommendation to the state legislature. And every single person that testified said, do not use these types of devices. Use direct paper ballots. Every expert. And it was literally the who's who of experts across the country testified to this. And they ignored
voter verifiable. Yeah, voter verifiable paper ballots is absolutely EFF's position on it as well. And just for folks, I realize we kind of skipped a piece. And just like for anyone who's here that doesn't know what voter verifiable paper ballots, what risk limiting audits is, I just wanted to like make sure that we're not leaving anyone else behind in the room, right? Jumping into the question as it was phrased. And essentially, risk limiting audit is a way that you can, depending on what the range is between the candidates, come up with a number or a percentage of votes that you can count that is significantly different, lower than the total number of votes that will give you a statistically, 90% or 90 significant, but almost close to 100% reliability that the votes were entered as tabulated. But as we just shared, that does require that the votes that what is being tabulated has been is able to be verified that it is what the voter submitted, and barring a voter verifiable paper ballot, it is certainly near impossible to be able to do that.
Okay.
I'm just mystified by this.
Go ahead.
Inertia that seems to defy every factual bit of input by every expert you can line up says, don't go that way. And they go, but we're going this way. And it's like they're completely tone deaf to what's being told to them. And this is not just in Georgia. There are other states that have this. So I don't work enough in the political process to understand what causes this kind of inertia.
I can try to address a little bit of that briefly. A lot of the history here ties back to the 2000 election, where there was a hotly contested result in Florida. There were the paper punch ballots with the hanging chads, where like a little bit of the paper was not fully coming off of the thing. It was embarrassing, right? It was delaying the count. And said, okay, we got to do something about this. And so Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, where they provided something very unusual for the government, which was a funded lack of mandate. Usually people complain about unfunded mandates coming from the government. Well, in this case, they had a whole bunch of money, but no standards. And then a bunch of companies whipped out as quickly as possible, hey, I've got the voting machine for you. And they created all these voting machines, and then a whole bunch of counties bought them. And one of the reasons why counties are trying to still use those kinds of voting machines is because they already have them. And switching to, I think a lot of people on the expert side would say optical scan, paper marked by the voter, optical scan to assist in doing it, risk limiting audits to make sure that the paper matches the electronic tally. Very good system. It's really only a good system, though, if you already have those things and you don't have to throw away all the ones that you have already invested in. So that's a big part of the problem, one that could be solved by more money plus standards. But there's been some more money coming out of Congress. But for whatever reasons, these things get partisan, it's difficult to get it resolved that way. And there's another issue, which is actually a very important one, that direct entry machines can be programmed in ways that are very, very helpful to people who are voting with disabilities, in ways that is more difficult to do with a paper ballot. You can do some of this with ballot marking devices, but I think there's a real genuine effort to try to use some of these more electronic marking methods to allow greater access to voting, easier voting for folks who have disabilities. And I think that can be managed, but that's another reason why going away from some of these devices raises political tensions.
Okay. All right. I wanted to cover the one of the questions in the chat that was about somebody who's looking for an EFA group and there's nothing listed in their state. So if you're looking for a group in your area and there's nobody listed in your area, what can you do about that? And what's the situation there?
Start one. if you can't find the group you want to organize with, organize it. If you live in a community and you've got three folks that are in your area, and right now, obviously in the time of COVID, it's very difficult to do like in-person meetups, but you can certainly, a lot of folks have now adapted to being able to meet online. And there's certainly a lot to be said about the need to kind of close the digital divide to make sure that that's accessible. But, let's not, at least in this moment, we don't want to make, perfect the adversary of good. So if you're able to use the tools that are at your resource to kind of bring a couple people in your community together that share the same motivation for change that you do, start reaching out to those folks and find who's there that wants to, that's trying to reach the accomplish the same goal as you. And if you need help, definitely go to eff.org/fight and we've got guidance there on, you know, how to do media outreach. We've got guidance there on how to like build coalitions. We've got guidance on there on all of the things, the pieces that you'll need to do, that you'll need to really to familiarize yourself with in order to start making that change. And reach out to us. The email address that I put into the chat there, which is organizing@eff.org, goes to myself and the rest of the members of the organizing team. And we're certainly there. We're certainly eager to help you find, you know, find the best way that you can move, move, you know, privacy, security, creativity, innovation, digital advocacy in your community, or digital education in your community, or to bring folks together, you know, after we've come out of this crisis, to bring folks together to kind of share tools and resources. We're excited to support that work. And like I said, it's really, if it's a for-profit organization, you won't be eligible for the EFA. If you're a political organization, because the EFF is a 501c3 and is therefore nonpartisan, that wouldn't be eligible. But if you're a community group or a student group or a nonprofit group that's working within your community to kind of to work within those five principles, reach out to us and we'd love to be able to support you in doing that work.
Okay. Thanks.
So while we have, a gap between questions, I just want to make sure we get all of the expertise on our panel for you today. So Erica, you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been working on?
Sure. Well, there's the whole other Earn It panel, so I'm not going to go too much into that there. But I would love to talk about some of the CertBot things that we've been doing, because that's been pretty exciting. So the big change that we've been working on lately is a packaging change, where we have CertBot packaged as a snap, and we're finally deprecating some of the old scripts that we used to have, which is great from a security perspective and from a maintainability perspective, and it will hopefully get it on more people's systems even easier. So for example, one of the things that's happening now is that Let's Encrypt is doing a deprecation of one of their old forms of the protocol, but old versions of CertBot only use that version, and due to a series of different versions and places and things like that.
Maybe people don't know, everybody in the audience here doesn't know what Let's Encrypt and CertBot is. So could you just give a brief?
Okay, yeah, I guess I said at the very beginning, so I can talk about that a bit more now. So if you want to get your website on HTTPS, then you're going to need a certificate. You're going to get that certificate from a certificate authority, which is a organization and some servers that hand out certificates to you. Let's Encrypt is a free and automated one. And along with CertBot, which is a client-side tool for talking to Let's Encrypt, it makes it free, easy, and automated to get certificates to turn your website to HTTPS. But CertBot is the client software, which means it needs to run on a variety of different devices. And so anyone who's worked in Linux systems is aware, it can be a bit difficult to make sure that things are updated over time, especially when you have a server that's changing things on their end as well. Because some Linux distributions are more focused on stability, for example, and so they might have older versions of CertBot. So the problem that we're hitting is that these older versions of CertBot won't be able to talk to the new protocol, and we want to get everyone's machines up to date before that deprecation happens. Probably around June is when that's going to be happening. So we're currently working with our packagers on those systems to get that fix in now manually by backporting a patch. But in the future, we would love to not have to be able to do that. So there's this new distribution system called Snaps, which has a lot of great features. It has a lot of containerization, which is great for security, and it's auto-updating in ways that are very convenient for both us and for the users. But at the same time, it does enough segmentation that it keeps things safe to make it a bit more of a secure way of doing it than just having a randomly auto-updating script, which is one of the very earliest ways that we used to offer CertBot. So we're pretty close to finishing up with that transition, actually. We have Snaps working for a variety of different architectures and systems, and we're working on starting to deprecate the older versions and make sure that everybody is smoothly transitioned from the older version to the newer one. So we can get people always having the latest version of CertBot that will always be kept up to date and working in the future. So that's been a pretty exciting thing to be working on, although it's certainly not as likely to come up in a question as many of the other topics that my colleagues have talked about today.
Well, it is a very important project. I mean, like before this project started, like it was expensive to get a certificate, and a lot of people were not doing it because they were didn't want to spend the money, didn't want to spend the time building it. And then through projects like Let's Encrypt and CertBot, we took away those excuses, right? I mean, we made it so it was free and easy. And I believe earlier this year, Let's Encrypt issued its 1 billionth certificate. And you know, so a tremendous success for the Encrypt All the Things, so that CertBot is enabling.
Oh, I just saw some new numbers today, actually. Let me just pull this up. We have CertBot has 2.4 million installations managing 14.5 million certs for 21.4 million domains. And that's just CertBot, not all of Let's Encrypt, which is pretty exciting.
And I'm always blown away by the percentage of the internet that was encrypted before Let's Encrypt launched and the percentage of the internet that is encrypted now. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm.
And it's not even just us. We're not the only people who offer certificates now, but the way that we've helped move the ecosystem forward, because when you move to automation, it really solves a lot of the fundamental problems for both getting and keeping certificates and keeping websites online when they have HTTPS, because if a certificate expires, of course, you're going to have a problem. Spotify had a problem a few months ago, I think, where their certificate had expired. They weren't using Let's Encrypt, but, you know, so they didn't have... It's because when you use a Let's Encrypt certificate, it expires every 3 months. So you need to have automation because that's way too often to be doing it every time. But when it's automated, you don't have to remember to do it every couple of years like you used to have to do. And the total length of time that a certificate is going to be allowed to be valid for is going down to a year. I don't remember the date, but sometime either just past or soon happening, maybe next year, something like that. Sometime in the near future or the recent past, certificate maximum lifetimes are going down to a year, which is very exciting for security because you ideally want to get that time as short as possible, because if something happens to a certificate, you know, someone hacks into the system and takes a copy of it out to create their own malicious system, you want that certificate to be only valid for a short amount of time before moving on to a new one that they don't have access to. So if we could start bringing that time lower and lower, which we can only do once automation becomes more widespread, we can increase the security of the internet as a whole, even beyond just getting it on HTTPS in the first place, which is very exciting.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, Haley, I know that you need to leave early, but just one, I guess, kind of parting question before you go. I know that EFF does track legislation at the federal level, but obviously the state level tracking is going on too. Can you talk a little bit more about the state level tracking that's going on and kind of what the effort is and what the team is like and what your process is?
Yeah, sure, happy to. And yes, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to hop up a little early, but thank you all for letting me come and talk with you. Yeah, so as Scott said, you know, we are looking at legislation all across the country. In terms of who the team is, you know, we have a legislative team dedicated solely to legislative, the state legislation. You're looking at her, but it is a lot of fun, and I really enjoy talking to everybody, and I really particularly enjoy getting suggestions of bills that EFA groups are interested in and that they are following. I think, you know, one thing that is important to us as we're looking at state legislation is that we really are in communication with people who are on the ground, who know, you know, nobody knows how to read a situation when it comes to legislation better than the people who are in that community. And so I think it's like very, very important that that we get to talk to folks about that. And you know, sometimes someone will, so in terms of process, a lot of times someone will say, hey, this is sort of a weird thing, you know, a bill that I came across, you know, or this is an issue that I care about and there's a legislator who's working on a bill. And you know, we have those conversations, we talk to those people, we try and figure out, you know, how we can be most helpful, whether that's connecting them to other resources, whether that's Emailing everyone on our list from who lives in that state. That's like one of my favorite things to do, to just kind of see where EFF can help all across the country, and you know, try and support them at every stage of the process. Legislation does move in stages, right? You're drafting, you're going through committees, you're at the floor, you're going to different houses. I have learned more about what different states call their crossover day, or second house day, or whatever, when they move from the Senate to the House and vice versa, than I ever thought I would. I love learning all about weird state legislative procedure across the country, and just figuring out when we can show up, send letters, amplify voices. So that's a little bit more about the process. Anything in particular I can illuminate?
Well, I guess I just wanted the general overview. So thank you very much for that. And thank you. I understand you need to drop off. So
I do to talk about a bill, because that is always what I'm doing. But thank you all so much. It was such a pleasure to chat with you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Haley.
Okay, so I wanted to bring up, if you do have any, we're getting near the end. If you have any final questions you'd like to ask, please put them in the chat, or you can use the raise hand feature by clicking on your own name and setting your status to raise hand, or you can turn on your camera at the bottom. One thing I would like to mention is, if you have questions after, during DragonCon, but after this particular talk, this is our kickoff talk, you can go to the DragonCon Discord server. And I'm posting the link for how to join the Discord server. It is a little bit of a test to see if you can follow all the steps, but you'll have to come into the Discord server, you'll have to agree to the user agreement, and then you have to do something called unlock the rooms. And our room is in the virtual Hilton, just like we're in the real Hilton when DragonCon is actually meeting. There's a virtual Hilton, so you have to unlock the Hilton or unlock all the hotels. But the instructions are there on the link that I put in the chat. So I hope I hadn't talked to anybody here on the conference before, but I hope that if you have a few extra minutes and you'd like to hang out in Discord and answer questions there, that would be an awesome, wonderful thing to do. And also, if anybody just has a question, they can post it on Discord during the convention, and we can forward it on to the right person if we see it, because we have our own people that are watching for questions and things like that out there. So we'll see your question. Certainly, if it's in the next couple of days during the convention, we'll try to forward it on. We're kind of getting close to the end, so we'd like to ask for people here, if you have any final thoughts, and also if there's any way that we can get connected with EFF and maybe contribute to the cause, please mention that. I guess I'll go one at a time. Let's start with Erica, and if you want to give us some final thoughts here.
Final thoughts. Let's see. Well, if you are following the EFF, you probably already know some of this, but we send out action alerts and we have our effector newsletter. So if you see anything go by where you're hoping to take action, that's a great way to do it. If we have automated ways of writing to your representatives, and it's not just like a button that you click. That's really like the thing that actually ends up mattering. Because at the end of the day, when the representatives hear from the people who they're representing, that's one of the best ways, no matter what we say, how poorly written the bill is or how much it's going to harm cryptography or anything like that, it is really important that they can hear that people are worried about this as well.
Okay, Fabian?
Yeah, so generally speaking, again, STOP is just working on COVID-19 surveillance within schools and geofence warrant, like pushback Otherwise, really great just to see how states have been a part of the paradigm shift in terms of thinking about legislation moving forward. I think it's really powerful to see like states like Minneapolis take the foot forward and really set a precedent on what it looks like to advocate against surveillance technology in places that we don't need it, and surveillance tracking in places that we don't need it, and putting it in the power of the people's hands, and making almost civil rights become digital in a way, and much more state-friendly on a digital platform. So I'm looking forward to seeing what that looks like moving forward. If anything, there's a lot of updated content on stopspying.org in terms of the company. I might have not put an active link, but basically you can copy and paste that and pop it up on the webs, pop it up on your like web, and it should pop up as such. Just in case if that's not popping up. Stopspying.org. So yeah, there's usually newsletters that pop up. I don't think we do automated campaigning. I apologize. We're probably not as hip as Erica, but there's definitely new newsletters that come out, press releases and things like that, that keep folks in touch with what's going on, at least within New York City and stuff like that. So looking forward to seeing what the future looks like, and thank you for having me.
All right, thanks. Okay, Kurt?
Yeah, thanks for having me as well. It's great to help kick off this year's Dragon Con with the Latino Frontiers track, and thanks everybody in the audience for coming and sticking around to hear us answer your questions and talk about these important issues. If you're interested, we've actually put a lot of links in the chat. I'll add one more, EFF.org, which has just come to our website. You can see our blog. You can just become a member and donate if you want to support EFF. Just learn a little bit more about what we do. And I guess, Nash, you can talk about this in a second, but as he's pointing out, there's our 30th birthday this year. So EFF has been around. Yes, that's longer than the World Wide Web has been around. EFF is from the ancient times where people were using dial-up modems, and web browsers didn't even exist. But a lot of the important civil liberties issues, the digital rights, remain the same, and we're going to continue to fight for those rights for another 30 years and more. So I guess thanks everybody for joining us.
Okay, Nash?
Hey, thanks everyone. I love the questions, I hope that folks will follow through and really like to stay motivated to start doing advocacy in your area, and either connect with a group that's doing work in your area. You can find out more about the Electronic Frontier Alliance at EFF.org/fight. And again, as Kurt just mentioned, this is EFF's 30th anniversary, so definitely we've got some really cool things to commemorate our 30th year. So check out the link that I put in there for the to celebrate our 30th anniversary. I'm also trying to, you caught me trying to pull up a link for the Pioneer Awards, because we've got our Pioneer Awards coming up soon, which is an opportunity like that we have every year to be able to really lift up folks that are doing amazing work in the, you know, in the area of empowering people or creating opportunities for change in the ways that our digital rights are protected. And I think I'm actually not sure if we've publicly announced who the winners are for this year. So I'm gonna just add the link as soon as I can find it, so that folks can just keep an eye on there. I think we were hoping to do it next month. We usually do it in the beginning of September. I think this year we're gonna push it back a little bit to October. Obviously, everyone's adjusting and adapting to the moment that we're living in with COVID right now. So if folks will bear with me for just a second, I'm gonna try and find you that link. But yeah, try to join us there so you can hear about some of the amazing work that's happened this year, in addition to the work that we've just spoken about that EFF's been doing. There's obviously amazing work of folks that we really admire, and we want to lift up and create an opportunity to recognize them. So I've just finally found the link as I was talking. So I'm going to add that in right now. And so, yeah, so just thanks everyone for the time that you've given. I hope everyone enjoys DragonCon. Join us tomorrow for the session on Earn It. And just keep up the fight. Thanks, y'all.
Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy your DragonCon Goes Virtual. I'll say goodbye to everyone now. Thanks.
All right, take care.